Welcome to the Commentary Magazine podcast. Today is Wednesday, March 25th, 2020. This is our daily podcast. With me, as always, Christine Rosen, senior writer. Hi, Christine.
Hi, John.
Abe Greenwald, senior editor. Hi, Abe.
Hi, John.
Associate editor Noah Rothman. Hi, Noah.
Hi, John.
And joining us today from the environs of Washington, public intellectual, official at the American Enterprise Institute, editor of National Affairs, longtime commentary contributor, and most importantly for our purposes, University of Chicago graduate, Yuval Levin. Hi, Yuval.
Hi, guys. Thanks very much for having me.
So you guys just be quiet. Yuval and I will start talking about, you know, Mandel Hall and, you know, and the Frog and Peach coffee shop and other highlights of the University of Chicago, and we'll bore everybody to death, and that'll be the end of this. Okay, Yuval, we asked you on not only because you're one of our favorite people and you you are writing a piece for an upcoming issue of Commentary, but because you have written a piece not for Commentary but for The Atlantic, published on Monday, called We Need a Hard Pause Followed by a Soft Start, that I thought was really an extraordinary summary of the what might be considered the non-hysterical position on our current crisis and the ways in which we will seek to extricate ourselves from it or evolve through it and out of it. Can you give us a little summary of your argument?
Well, sure. Thank you. Thanks for having me on. I'm a huge fan of the podcast, so it's a little surreal to be a part of it. And I hope you can't hear my children screaming upstairs, because I can. the piece basically tries to speak to the problem that I think is now confronting our key decision makers in Washington, which is there isn't really a strategic framework for how we're thinking about the purpose of public policy in responding to this crisis. There's not a clear purpose that we're aiming toward and that we can judge our actions by. Basically, I think we need to think about what we're doing not as either letting the economy be strangled by the needs of public health or letting people die because we need to reopen the economy. We need to think exactly about how to balance those two things by thinking sequentially that in order to get to a place where we can live safely with the virus, because we're not going to beat it for a while, we need first a hard stop where we have this extreme social distancing and the economy is effectively shut down, and then a gradual resumption of economic activity and school and work and other things that happens gradually so that it can be done carefully and in response to some understanding of the state of the spread of this virus. We couldn't get to that balance by gradually gearing down from normal life because we'd be taking huge risks in doing that. We have to get to it by gradually gearing up from a complete stop, which is basically what we're working toward now. So the argument is not that we've got to start reopening things now, but that we're going to be doing that in a matter of weeks and not months, and we need to start thinking about what that has to look like now.
So Andrew Cuomo, the governor of New York, where there are five times the number of cases as anywhere else or 10 times the number of cases as anywhere else, gave a press conference yesterday morning that was the first time that I really felt myself plunge into despair, oddly enough, the first time, in part because it seemed so bizarrely discontinuous. So it was apocalyptic. We need 30,000 ventilators. We don't have them. 14 to 21 days is when the apex of this is going to hit. We're going to have emergency room visits that we can't handle. Other diseases are going to go by the wayside. You know, we're setting up temporary hospitals and convention centers, and you know, we have to do this. And there's no way to stop it. And the only people who are going to be able to emerge from this and then go to work and do all this, in his opinion, were people who had the virus and therefore lived through it and therefore somehow had this antibody that supposedly we'll have some test for. And so they could, like, resume life. everyone's praising Cuomo, right? It's crazy. He's so fantastic. He's doing so great, you know, because they want an anti-Trump and all that. But what I heard from this was all the social distancing that people in New York, like me and Abe and Noah in the environs, and like you guys in Washington, we've been doing it for like 2.5 weeks. That it's useless. It was useless. Like we didn't do anything really to stop it. Maybe we slowed it down a little bit, but it's coming. The wave is coming. The tsunami is coming. So thanks a lot. So basically, I've been living, you know, basically in jail for almost 3 weeks, and it was ineffectual. So first of all, I think that's a horrible message. I don't know, you know, he's so lame and bad at this, Cuomo,
else, establishing as the predicate at which point you can re-enter society, becoming infected establishes a pretty perverse set of incentives.
That's what I'm saying. So Cuomo is a terrible communicator, and he's a bad like I'm not a fan of his, but fine. So he's like being serious about it, so everybody likes him nonetheless. So this message was like, okay, so this is useless. It's coming anyway. You know, you got to give us ventilators. Everything is terrible, but we New Yorkers are tough. It's going to take months. I don't know. So it's like total despair, paranoia, dread. And so that's the counter message to Trump. I don't understand.
Let me ask. Can I ask you, Vol, a real quick question? Because I actually found his piece was like a balm to my soul reading. It was like soothing because it made sense in the way that when Anthony Fauci gets up and talks about the pandemic, it makes sense and it's reassuring to people. But the question I have, and I think this speaks to what John is expressing about Cuomo, is that regionally there are still vast differences between like the city of New York and, you know, Butte, Montana. So the question of how we have this hard stop, soft, you know, restart discussion in a regional way. Look, federalism is the strength of our country, but we're finding this strange push-pull between we need a federal response, we need the federal government to step in, we need a bailout, et cetera, et cetera. But then you have local leaders actually trying to communicate to citizens on the ground what they should do on a day-to-day basis. How do we square that circle and get a message that's reliably consistent for people who are in dire situations like people in New York City right now in terms of contagion versus people who aren't yet there? Is there a way to do that?
I think the regional differences are actually key to what's going on here. New York City really is in a very, very different situation than just about anywhere else in the country, and certainly than the less dense parts of the country. I think other cities will find themselves in a similar place, and there have been some cities who've done a much worse job of public health than New York. New Orleans, for example, is going to be in a very bad place in 2 weeks. I think at a greater degree than what New York is seeing now relative to its population and its health system. But there are also large parts of the country where they now are in much more of a kind of broad containment mode than a response mode. And in order to start going back to work and life, I think we're going to have a much more fine-grained sense of what this looks like, of where the epidemic is in the United States. That's going to require a lot more testing than we're doing now. And I think alongside more of the swab tests that we're doing, which we need a lot more of, you also need to have blood tests for antigens, which are possible and which have basically already been developed. And that's what Cuomo was getting at. Those tests will tell you who has some antigens, who's been exposed that isn't currently sick. Some of those people never were sick. Some were and have gotten better. The researchers don't even know whether that means they're immune exactly, right? This is a new virus. Humanity's never quite confronted it before. It's related to things we know, but it's not exactly something we know. And I think over time, over the next few weeks, there's going to have to be a massive surge of both kinds of testing if we're going to get to a place where you can gradually tell people to start taking measures to go back. That's not going to happen right away. And, you know, ironically, the fact that New York City is in such an extreme place actually means that it's probably going to happen sooner in a place like that than it will happen in other major cities that are going into this a little more slowly and gradually. But I think that it's absolutely necessary that people start planning, that leaders in these different places and the federal government start planning for how to help people return to life. And the answer is not just whoever has been sick can go back. The answer is we're going to go back in careful, gradual ways with masks, which, by the way, everybody's told us masks don't do anything. Masks are very effective. And, you know, the message is going to have to be, for a while, we need to be careful about this because a vaccine is a year away. That's the real game changer. In the meantime, there'll be better treatments. There'll be a better understanding of what works and what doesn't. But all this has to happen gradually, and gradually actually means you have to plan.
I think what's going to delay this kind of shift in public policy and this move back to a gradual restoration of a more vibrant public life is that public leaders are afraid to say what Yuval says in his piece, which is this is really about learning, in some sense, figuring out how to live alongside the virus. Without that, the problem with all our public policy now is that it's aimed toward a kind of fantasy, which is eradication. No one says exactly how it's going to be eradicated. I mean, Trump says it'll disappear, but even if you don't use language that absurd, the idea is we do this and then somehow we emerge in a world without COVID-19. And that's a fantasy.
Yeah, I think it's very difficult for political leaders now to say that what we're aiming for is a way to live with this for a while, right? For a year and more. It's going to be a matter of being careful about it. And look, the more they know about it, the easier that becomes. I do think that there will be ways of treating the most extreme cases that make them a little less extreme. But none of that is what people want to say, right? What a governor or a mayor wants to say, or a president, is hang on, this will be resolved, and then you can go back. And that hanging on is not going to be sustainable. You cannot stop the economy for 18 months. That may be what the public health models would love for us to do, but it's just not possible. And the real challenge of being a leader, especially being president at this point, is that you have to balance these very hard trade-offs. There really is a trade-off between public health and economics here. It doesn't mean you say that the elderly should be willing to die for the economy. That's not what the trade-off looks like. But it looks like helping people be careful so that they can return to work gradually while this virus is still out there. And that's no easy thing.
Okay, so Yuval, you have said earlier in the podcast that we need to begin from a complete stop. And daily listeners will be annoyed at my invocation of this, but my perspective in from quarantine has gotten much smaller to the street level. And on my street, there is no complete stop. I'm in a working class neighborhood where people are still going to work because they cannot afford to not go to work. They cannot wait for a check that arrives date uncertain from the public or from the public sector. And to the extent that that would even suffice, it's not possible for these people to sever the family networks, the community networks that make them, that make the neighborhood next door who barely speaks English and makes them able to navigate my neighborhood. And you'd suggested in your piece, and something that I think a lot of progressives who read it and liked it latched onto, was the prospect of introducing something like a Denmark model, where the government picks up 75% of your salary. The notion that that is possible, it doesn't seem, I don't know if that's in the language of this particular stimulus bill, but I don't think that's forthcoming. And in its absence, what do you think the prospects are for people who can't afford to stop working to simply stop? I just think that that's unrealistic and unlikely.
So the stimulus bill has a little bit of this in it, in what they're calling forgivable loans, which is a huge, very poorly defined piece of the bill that the Senate is passing, which basically says businesses can get business loans from American banks, and if they prove that they use them to sustain payroll or pay rent, then the loans will be forgiven, and basically the government will back them up. The bill provides about $300 billion to pay for this, but it doesn't say how we're going to decide who gets it and who doesn't. So lots of small businesses are going to do this. It's going to cost a lot more than $300 billion. Ultimately, Congress will come back and fill that in. And it's a little bit like what Denmark, or it's a little closer to what the UK is doing, which is basically saying to businesses, this is temporary. We understand it's very hard. We want you to keep your payroll. Don't fire everybody. Keep them on while you're closed, and it will make you whole. I think there are a number of problems with how that's working. I don't think many small business owners even know about this, and it hasn't been communicated to them. I've never heard the president talk about this, and nobody else really has a platform to do it. And, you know, it's also going to be hugely expensive and hugely challenging. So I think the problem you point to is right. It is very, very hard for people to take this pause. And the purpose of public policy right now, or of the economic support policy, needs to be to help them take this pause, so that I don't think that it's a good idea to funnel a lot of this money through unemployment insurance, because we precisely don't want people to feel like their only option is unemployment insurance. And there has to be much more communication about the help that's being offered. I don't think it's being done well, but I would say that's the goal that that we ought to have for the economic side of what policymakers are doing now, is helping people pause, hold their place, keep their job for the period that, where we really have to have the economy shut down. Obviously, it's not going to work perfectly. It's going to be very, very far from perfect. It's going to work horribly. But to the extent that we can improve things a little, I think that should be the purpose that policymakers have in mind.
Well, so we, you know, again, using New York as the, you know, as the leading edge, or some places like Israel, where they've taken extraordinarily aggressive measures, really over beginning a month ago, to make sure that they can eradicate it, or that it doesn't really arrive there at all. The New York model proposes effectively that there is a way, theoretically, to prevent the virus from spreading everywhere in a cascade over the course of a year. In other words, if we can control, if we can flatten the curve here and get it contained here, the spread by definition will be less extreme as it moves, say, west, or, you know, to less populous areas, and all that. The problem is this not just a communication matter, but a tone matter, which is it still hasn't hit yet. You see, these numbers that we're seeing do not justify a $6 trillion economic infusion directly from the government and the Fed. And so trying to make it clear to people in New Orleans or in Houston or something like that, that maybe what they should do is unilaterally shut their cities down when they don't even have cases, is going to be very difficult to make until a cataclysm occurs. And then this is the question that is raised, the despairing question, which is, if the cataclysm occurs here in New York in 2 or 3 weeks, will it be too late for Houston? Is the spread of this the sort of thing that the very things that we didn't do in January, February, people locally are not doing in March and April to make sure that May and June don't see corpses piling up and people, you know, not being able to be on ventilators and these Hobson's choices being made about who shall live and who shall die. And I think for some of us, we still remain, and I mean me too, like I still remain in this, every 15 minutes, I can't really believe it's happening. And then I look at the gross numbers and I'm like, you know, maybe it isn't really happening. And what we're seeing here is the world is the largest overreaction in the history of the planet to something. And so that's, again, it's like, okay, so we'll shut the entire economy down. And then it sort of rolls over and it's like, it's worse than the flu. So it's 50,000 deaths as opposed to 35,000 deaths as in 2019. And we will have spent $6 trillion we don't really have to shut the world down, to cause unbelievable pain that will linger for a long time. And I don't know how to address that, because there is Ron DeSantis in Florida, a guy who has been doing a brilliant job as governor, right? That's a remarkable job. People love him. He's had a great couple of years. He's got an extraordinarily elderly population, and he is refusing to do a pause. And I'm not sure I understand why, because I don't know what the political, unless he really doesn't believe that the tsunami is coming.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think there's been a disconnect between the public health world and the political world and the rest of us in this from the beginning, because to the people who work on these things all the time, this is the big one. This is what they have been theorizing and studying about since they went to college. This is what it looks like. It's a respiratory virus that spreads in this kind of exponential way. It starts in China. It hits Europe really hard. This is exactly what they've always worried about most. I would say the only way in which it isn't is that somehow miraculously this isn't hurting children, which I can't imagine what it would be like to live on planet Earth right now if this were hurting children in the way that the flu does, for example. It would be a million times worse. But in every other way, this looks like the kind of respiratory pandemic that overwhelms health systems. And the hard thing to get across, I think, is that that's the problem, is the overwhelming of health systems, more than numbers of deaths in the millions, which let's hope we don't see from this thing, and I certainly hope we don't see, is the fact that it leaves hospitals incapable of functioning wherever it hits. And that is happening. That's going to be happening in New York City very, very soon. It's going to be happening in other places just a little bit later. And it's very hard for politicians to convey to people that we're taking extreme measures now so that a problem that will be terrible in a few weeks could be less terrible than it otherwise would have been. There's just no winning if you're a politician and that's what you're saying. If you do well, then it'll look like you overreacted. If you do just moderately well, it'll look like you failed. But I do think there's reason to think that the measures we're taking now are working. They are now happening across the country, not just in New York and not just in places that are seeing them in the most extreme ways. There are certainly places that are resisting some, but gradually everything is shutting down. And, you know, ultimately, it certainly could turn out that this just passes much more easily than we think, but it doesn't look that way. I mean,
but it's not hard to say what you just – but what you're saying, Yuval, the press is very receptive to that message. It's not difficult to say that and get a warm reception. What's difficult to say, and what there is a stigma around, indicative of, in many ways, of a panic, is the notion that this can't last much longer. That when the if we don't spin up society in the next 2 weeks, there might not be a society left to spin up. That's the sort of thing that a lot of people with whom I'm in contact with fear, that they don't have a safety net, that they don't see a future beyond 2 weeks from now, and that we do need to get economic activity rolling again in the near term. In the short
but
term.
There is no, but the problem with this is there is no we. It's like I keep hearing we, this kind of collective American we. When I heard, I just had Stephanie Ruhle on, and she was like, you know, look, the frontline workers in this crisis are working supermarkets and places like that. We shouldn't we be paying them more? Back in a minute. We don't pay supermarket workers.
Yeah.
Supermarket workers are paid based on how the market functions, right? There is no we to restart the economy in an odd way. You know, you're saying it can't be sustained if the people that you live around, if the people who they depend on for their business aren't going to leave their homes. If you're a mechanic and no one drives a car in, you're not going to make money fixing the car. I mean, this is what's going on with restaurants in the United States. They're not being shut down by order of the governor, you know, because of, you know, the way theaters were in the, you know, in the Renaissance in England because of plague. They're being told you can't have people sitting there, but you can do takeout food. And it's an apocalypse. Like, they're losing 80 to 90, but they can't afford to maintain payroll, and this bill that we have now isn't fast enough, isn't going to get money to them fast enough for them. Mm-hmm. Maybe they can rehire people and then take these loans or whatever they are, the subventions, to keep it going. So there is no we. Where there is a we is sort of like, the question is whether the economy is going to stop at all in 10 or 15 states. And then the terror of this is, so, you know, the sort of like less populous states, Nevada, Idaho, Wyoming, North Dakota, South Dakota, they don't do this at all because it's like it's not happening to us and we don't have a problem. We can't afford it. And then everybody else does or something like that. And then in September, it hits them like a tidal wave. And then we have a second wave of the disease, and then it spreads from them back, you know, and everybody hasn't gotten it. And then there's another like that. So you know, every apocalyptic scenario you can come up with depends on some understanding of a communitarian responsibility across 330 million people that if we ever felt in the United States, which I don't think we really did, except in, you know, maybe for 2 weeks after 9/11, you know, in my lifetime, you know, is not real. But that doesn't mean that your friend, your neighbors who are going to go to work are going to have any customers. So it's not like the economy will just start up magically because there'll be customers and clients. Anyway, Abe, sorry.
Yeah, no, I just want to make a point about this because I've been seeing lately, and I've been seeing a lot of this using the crisis conditions to justify arguments about paying people more, as you alluded to. And it's such a bad idea because by the same token, should we say now, well, doesn't this prove that we should pay teachers less? Because
now
you're going to get a lot of hate mail.
Right. But my point is, I'm speaking to what a bad idea it is to extrapolate from this.
I will extrapolate. Yeah. I'm going to extrapolate one thing from this, which is if the Democrats are now triply lucky that they did not nominate Bernie Sanders, because the idea in political terms that in 2021, there's going to be a big political reset and suddenly there's going to be all this money to spend to repurpose to all of the, you know, liberal progressive desiderata, that's gone. There is going to be no money for nothing. And we are going to have to raise taxes, and those taxes, that tax money is going to have to go so that we do not have a $40 trillion debt, national debt. I mean, we're heading toward a $30 trillion national debt from what I can tell as a result of this.
And the Social Security Hospital Fund, Medicare Hospital Fund, is still insolvent in 2026.
And we but that's a whole other let's not even go. That's Yuval's favorite subject.
Don't get me started.
Let's not even go there. I'm just saying that this notion, the James Clyburn notion that we can really reset things to our priorities, is so dementedly short-sighted. I mean, we are going to have a government that is going to live under terms of privation that I don't think we will have seen in our lifetimes.
I mean, I think the question of the politics of all that look like after this is just impossibly complicated to figure out from where we sit. I mean, it's so hard to know how we feel about our government after this is over. That I think politics around these questions just has to be very short term at this point, and rightfully so. It really is an emergency, and we're trying to think about how to minimize the pain to people. But I do think the point you make, John, gets at the problem that we're going to have when we try to restart things anywhere, which is there has to be a genuinely reassuring voice that says it's okay to go back, because it doesn't help to open your business if none of your customers feel like they can go out of the house. And that means there's going to have to be some sort of we, at least in a regional way, but probably in some level in a national way, that helps us say, this isn't over yet, there's not a vaccine yet, but if I do these things, I have a decent chance of keeping my family safe and I need to go back to work. I think at this point, in the places where this is focused, very few people feel like they can responsibly say that, and they're going to have to be helped to say that. And I don't know where that's going to come from, because it's not going to come from President Trump.
And you're also going to have there are two different types of people in a crisis like this, right? There are the people for whom this is the ultimate trigger, like an actual trigger, a life trigger. Contagion, disease, the fear of disease, the idea of sickness, the idea that your family is vulnerable and possibly, you know, in line of something terribly fatal. And so what you want to do is curl up in a ball and hide until the disaster goes. And then there are the people who, in the middle of a hurricane, want to go out in a boat. And these are two, you know, we can go back to our University of Chicago Aristotle. These are the gradations of human behavior along a scale. People who are more hardier or more reckless, and people who are more or who are excessively prudent or excessively fearful. And so that's the other part of this problem, is that the people who are by nature more risk-taking, let's say, or less fearful or something like that, are looking at this and saying, this is all crap. This is all crap, and it's all, they're just trying to get Trump, whatever it is that they're going to say, like, I'm not going to live like this. And then the other people, for the first time, are saying, you are going to kill my grandmother. You're going to kill my mother. You're a murderer. You're killing people by going outside. And how you achieve social peace in the middle, not just having authorities tell you this, yeah, but people are not going to surrender this feeling. So the people who are terrified, their terror is not, they're not going to wake up one morning and the terror is going to be gone. Like, this is a lifelong battle that people have with this emotion. You know, do you want to be outdoors or do you want to stay inside? Are you, you know, are you agoraphobic or are you compulsively social? You know, this is, Christine.
Well, I think the example, the very strange and actually tragic example from this week, which proves this point, is the couple that took the fish cleaner, yeah, because they had heard, you know, Trump talking about this drug that's going to be tested. So the reaction to that was really fascinating, right? You had some people saying Trump has killed these people because he was saying irresponsible things. And so as a result, they ate something completely unrelated to what he was talking about that sounded similar. You had a kind of strange faux sympathy coming from a technocratic elite, which basically thinks these people were stupid, but wants to nail Trump for doing something they dislike. And so there was a strange comfort to the level of irrational partisanship that was on display there. But what I heard was what you're describing, John, which was, I was concerned because, again, who could have stepped in at that particular moment and reassured us both that this was a horrible tragedy and we don't want misinformation spreading, but also said, you know what, we are going to look at these new treatments because it's all we can do right now is try to innovate. And I mean, maybe Fauci, but he's in the public health model, yeah, that mindset, which Yuval was talking about earlier. Who, we do not have that. There's a big vacuum right now for that reassurer in chief, and we need one. It doesn't have to be the president, but we don't really have anyone else that I know of.
I think this is why it's particularly important to help policymakers, politicians, whoever might be willing to step up, talk in terms of phases. The only way to really be reassuring now is to talk about now, later, and latest, right? Is to talk about short term, where we're nearing the peak of this thing in some places, and we have to stay home, and we have to hang on, and after that, in the medium term, we're going to gradually begin to restart things. And after that, in the longer term, we have this massive medical research infrastructure that is working on treatments and vaccine. And in each of those phases, there is something the government can do to be helpful. There's something each of us can do to be constructive. No one is talking in that way right now because the politicians themselves are, you know, their jobs are horrible. I mean, none of them wants to be where they are right now. They're facing horrible pressure and enormous burdens, and they're not thinking about how to help people think about this in a way that helps you see that it's not always going to be this horrible. And no one is doing that job. I mean, I think there are really important failures of decision-making in our government, but there's an especially horrible failure of reassurance and communication that's making this worse than it has to be.
Okay, Cuomo said briefly, though, I mean, I think that gets close to it, as horrible as the implications of it were, which is that in the absence of a vaccine, or even in the absence of an FDA-approved therapy like the a conditional approval for a chloroquine Z-Pak, you know, treatment, that everybody's going to get it, and the only it spreads like the cold. You probably got it already, and the condition here is that we're just trying to stagger these rates of infection so that they don't overwhelm the hospital system, and that's really it. And to say that out loud is rather ghoulish, but that seems
well.
To be
everything else everybody is saying is ghoulish. So I don't know. Yeah. You know what I mean? I mean, it's not as though
nobody wants to hear that. But well, if you were to say that out loud, then the notion that you should self quarantine seems rather silly.
I want to make a larger quickly before we. End this today. A larger implicit point about our politics. The Democratic nominating process came down effectively to a 77-year-old man and a 78-year-old man who had a heart attack, correct? And over time, we're like, is this really such a good? It's so old and all this. And it's like, oh, what are you doing? You're ageist, and you're this and you're that. And it's fine. You had a heart attack, and nobody cared. Whatever. Okay. So, well, guess why it's a problem to have a 77 and a 78-year-old man as president? Because they are susceptible to illness more than other people. They are less hardy than other people. Just simply as a matter of the physical response of the body over time. And so you are setting yourself in a condition when you say, yeah, that doesn't matter or whatever. What you're saying is I can't envision a moment in which it actually matters that the president be extremely healthy. And it turns out it matters a lot, because not just in this case, very specific case where this is a disease that's to which the elderly are uniquely susceptible and to whom it is uniquely dangerous, but because other things could happen. Yeah, they could. You want them to run things. They have a heart attack. They're out of commission. You didn't really vote for the vice president, and all of that. So this whole notion that it really doesn't matter, that these implicit questions everybody had. It's like, you are too old to be president. We were not somehow supposed to ask this time, or the public was not supposed to engage particularly. It was too offensive. Similarly, if you want to play the, both sides game, doing the, let's just blow everything up and we'll pick a guy who has never managed a public system of any sort, has never run a government, has never run a state house or a city, or been a senator, been responsive to constituents or anything like that, and has some understanding of how public financing works or how this works or how that works. And it's like, it's great. We can just do whatever here. We can do whatever. There will have 12 governors and 18 senators running in 2016, and the Republicans thinking that government is nonsense and awful and everything is terrible, and so you might as well just blow it up and go with this, unproven, leader whom from television and all of that. We're going to see how parlous the potential consequences of that kind of choice were, that we as a country, as a set of parties and everything like that, got ourselves in a position where we took our own role as self-governors, choosing the people who run our systems, that we took it so unseriously that we ended up, again, like with Hillary Clinton, who had no business. Okay, so she was a senator for a while and a secretary of state. Her sole qualification was that she was the wife of a president and a reality TV show star who had gone bankrupt several times as a real estate developer. And now these two old men. We better wisen up, because as Noah said, aside from everything else, and Yuval's great subject, we are heading for a decade in which our entitlements are going to go broke, and we are going horrendous choices to make.
This is kind of a piece that I'm writing right now, and I don't want to give away the premise, but essentially that we had been a very frivolous people for quite a long time, deferring very hard choices into future generations, creating existential crises out of absolute banalities. And now this has been thrust upon us, and it is a real crisis, and we are forced with the toughest of choices, triaging people, determining, whether this grandmother should die so that the Zoomer who licked the toilet seat might live. And this is the sort of thing that we have to now choose. And to an extent, we are rising to the occasion. And I don't think that's something we should overlook, the fact that these frivolities that have preoccupied us for so long are now gone. And the country is rising to the moment. Yet to be seen whether we meet it, but we are rising.
Yeah, that's important to see. We're mobilizing too. I mean, in a lot of ways, it's easy to complain about how slowly things are moving, but things are actually moving pretty quickly. And our country has risen to this challenge. But the point that John gets at, it matters who the president is. It just turns out to matter. I think this was easier to see in the Cold War, when you would have to ask yourself, do we want this person with a finger on the button? And we've gotten into a place where there isn't that kind of question. And we've been able to think of the president as a kind of entertainer. And it turns out to matter that this person has some experience dealing with pressure, making hard decisions, thinking seriously about the responsibility of the job. We have to think that way again.
Right. And I also think that, you know, it's a challenge that Trump may meet. And I don't really think that, you know, the kinds of attacks that he has been absorbing over the last week for saying things like, there could be a really effective treatment here. I mean, we should be optimistic about this. Or I really hope that we can reopen by Easter Sunday because he believes that. Yeah,
I'm going to interrupt on that one because I think that was a huge mistake as a method of communication, because without there had been no end date. And then suddenly he's saying it would be beautiful, beautiful Easter. It's a beautiful time of year. It'll be I want to see full churches on Easter. That was bad, but only because in the context of having absolutely zero end to a lot of these shutdowns, right. He gave a specific date. I don't think he intended it to be this will be the end date. I do think it was for him being hopeful about that, but he was so decisive about giving us a specific date that it was interpreted like that.
But again, that's what's wrong with his method of communication, which is that it is so insanely unnuanced that if he said, look, there are some treatments that are coming online, I'm not going to mention what they are because, you know, I'm too responsible. I don't want to, like, have people buying stock in the company that is developing them, or I don't want to have, you know, a run on the medication. But, you know, we see some things. There are some clinical trials starting, and I really hope that we can restart, you know, that people are able to go out and enjoy the spring, whatever it is. That he just does not have the capacity to do.
I don't know if I agree with Christine here. It's indefinite for the foreseeable future. Is you might as well say don't listen, don't bother, because that.
No, I agree with that. But that's what he has done.
It's a psychological bridge for a lot of people to get to hunker down for 2, 3, 4 weeks, even if it ends up being longer, extended conditionally. To just say this is going to be the case for the next foreseeable future. This is how you have to live your life. That's destined to fail.
I think you want to say weeks, not months. You don't want to say Easter. That's 3 weeks away. It's a particular date. It's going to come and go. And you just have to think, what's it going to look like on that day when a lot of people are still, when everybody is still stuck at home?
I mean, you know, there is this interesting dispute on the right, about how to respond to this, particularly in places of faith. And you have this idea that it's so terrible to say that people can't, you know, go to places of worship, that it is, you know, worth risking your life in order to have that kind of communion, since, in the words of one particularly irresponsible piece, you know, we all live under the dominion of death anyway. So
that's how the virus, by the way, started in D.C. It was during it was an infected church leader at a church here in my neighborhood who gave communion to 200 people who all drank out of the same cup. I mean, it started in a church.
and a Hasidic wedding or a Haredi wedding in Brooklyn that seems to have generated hundreds upon hundreds of cases. And, you know, I mean, I have friends. I have a very, very dear friend whose daughter had a bat mitzvah scheduled for Saturday. And, you know, family coming in from all over and all of that. And she is now doing it by Zoom. She's been preparing for this for 2 years. And, you know, it's not a tragedy, you know. It's pretty close to being, you know, a parent's nightmare that such a thing should happen. So she's not dead and her family's not dead, and that's all good. I'm only saying that there is a kind of bravado to the, this is going to end, and Trump likes bravado. And bravado is the worst possible tone here. Hope is not the worst possible tone, and the idea that we are getting somewhere and doing something, and that this team that's standing with him at these press conferences, Dr. Birx and the Surgeon General and Dr. Fauci, and, you know, that they know what they're doing, and that they are, and that progress is being made in an incremental way, that's all to the good. It's these, I think this is where Chris, the specificity of the promises is terrible, because you know, what if the lupus medication, the name of which I keep going up on, hydrochloroquizazine, or whatever it is, you know,
Gesundheit.
But I'm
what if it's not effective? You know, you don't want to name it. Like, then you
but
just.
But that was, in fairness, that information about that was bubbling up before Trump mentioned it. I mean, that was out there. And, but I'm also inclined to agree with Noah here, because it's hard for me to sort of figure out what's between open-ended vagueness and specificity. You know?
A date certain that can be extended, conditions permitting.
Which is what Fauci said, a version of that.
Let me end on this note of totally crushing morosity, right? So the ultimate way to release people, right, is to ramp up testing to an extraordinary level, right? So that basically you can see some kind of a demographic, geographic timeline pattern to the disease that will suggest that this area is okay, or that this population is, you know, almost entirely not going to suffer, whatever. Okay, that's hundreds of millions of tests, right? I mean, theoretically, or 100 million tests. Well, and I know they're going to start sending them to your house and all this. Well, so I've already heard two different stories about people who were tested and Quest Diagnostics lost their test. In the system, like it was sent to the wrong, whatever, you know, these labs are not equipped to handle 100 million tests in 3 weeks. I mean, how is that going to work? I mean, part of this is all, they're based on this, well, you know, World War II, you know, we mobilized the country and then we won the war. Well, first of all, it took 3.5 years to win the war. Second of all, we lost the war. We were losing the war in the first year of the war. We built a lot of bad planes in the early going that crashed into the Pacific. I mean, it's not, you know, you can't just snap your fingers and imagine competent, you know, that there is going to be sort of like competency in these highly specified things like how to make a ventilator, how to make sure that a test is positive or negative or something like that. And so there you have the other problem, which is, well, here's the solution. We just need a lot of testing. Well, you know what? I would like to know, just for the sake of argument, like, what is the modality for those tests and that, you know, it doesn't take three, they're not piled up for 3 weeks, and then I assume that after, like, 4 or 5 days, they lose their, whatever, the blood, particularly with blood, right? I know this from reading about Elizabeth Holmes and Theranos, that blood loses its... whatever it is, it's readability. Well,
potency for testing.
Right, or it's readability in a pretty short order. So, you know, anyway, that's my other, I'm like Mr. Optimistic, generally speaking, and like the more I think about this, the more I just don't understand how.
So it's not... like a group hug here on the podcast.
I'm
at the
sorry.
End.
Yeah. But yeah. Yuval, since you said, why don't you finish up with the hoped, you know, the soft start, or the, you know.
Yeah. Well, look, I think that soft start does require some competence at this level, and especially around testing. But I think once we're talking about blood tests, we actually run a lot of blood tests in America all the time. And if you can attach this to the existing layers of lab work that's done now and get to a test that gives you results in 45 minutes, which we're not far from, some of these competence problems are ultimately overwhelmed by volume. If you're running large millions of numbers of tests, certainly there'll be a lot of errors, but there'll also be a general picture of where things stand. And I think that's generally what makes mobilization practical, is the volume. It doesn't go well. There's just so much of it that you do overwhelm the problem. That is kind of how we won World War II, and it is kind of how mobilization works. But, you know, we're in this phase now where we're not even in the worst of the crisis. I mean, this is going to look a lot worse in 2 weeks, not better. Right. And where we're only at the opening edges of that mobilization. And so certainly it can be hard to see how it could work. But I do think the United States is good at mobilizing. And we have begun to see that. And the country is rising to this challenge, so that there really are reasons to think that a way forward is before us here. But, you know, the hardest part is ahead of us, too. There's no way around that.
Okay, well, that was almost optimistic.
Very optimistic for this.
After my trying to send everybody into the depths of despair into which Andrew Cuomo plunged me yesterday before noon. Yuval, thank you so much for joining us today. And for Christine Abenoa, I'm John Podhoretz. Keep the candle burning.